Today we're talking to José Gordillo,
Bolivian historian, originally from Cochabamba. He teaches Latin American history at the University of Calgary in Canada.
He is the author of Peasant Wars in Bolivia, Making, Thinking, and Living the Revolution in Cochabamba, 1952-1964, a book published in 2022.
The title is, of course, a reference to the classic work of Eric Wolff, Peasant Wars of the 20th Century.
In contrast to previous historiography that considers peasants marginal actors, José Gordillo puts peasants at the center of the history of the revolution. In this interview, he unpacks the role played by peasants of Cochabamba in the context of the revolution. Then he discusses the importance of paying attention to regional history and regional differences. He argues that previous scholarship usually talk about Bolivian peasants as a unified and homogeneous category. By focusing on the history of Cochabamba, he demonstrates that the peasants of this region, due to its specific pre-colonial and colonial history, had a different agenda vis-a-vis, for example, Bolivian peasants of the highlands. So he demonstrates that generic terms such as Indians or peasants obscure critical regional differences and political agendas. Finally, in discussing the legacies of the revolution, he unravels how these specific regional histories have shaped rural political mobilization in Bolivia today.
José, I'm very glad to have you in the program. I want to ask you, why do you think peasants are the central actor of the Bolivian Revolution?
In my opinion, both peasants and mine workers were the most important political actors of the Bolivian Revolution. However, while mine workers have always been at the center of the revolutionary narrative, peasants were marginal to that historical narrative, if not simply ignored. In contrast to the Mexican Revolution, for instance, where peasants were considered as the prodigal sons of the revolutionary regime, Bolivian peasants were invisible or were viewed as passive political actors that were subordinated to the revolutionary state's power. There are several reasons that explain this difference between Mexico and Bolivia, and one of them is socioeconomic. When the revolution started in 1910, Mexico's liberal economy was booming. Silver mining was not the leading industry anymore, and agriculture was an export-oriented activity. Both the mines and the haciendas depended on free labor rather than extra-economic state coercion. Mexico at that point was a mestizo nation, where only 15% of the population was Indian. In contrast, Bolivian liberal economy in 1952 was declining. Tin prices plummeted as did the Bolivian economy, because the mining sector was the only export-oriented economy or industry. Due to the stagnation of mine markets, the Altiplano and Valley haciendas were also in crisis. The hacienda owners' common solution was to increase extra-economic coercion upon members of the Indian labor force, while bankrupt valley landowners in Cochabamba found a complementary solution by selling plots of land to mestizo laborers. Even though Indians were 60% of the Bolivian population at this time, mestizos made up a quarter of the country's population, and the majority of them lived in the Cochabamba Valley region. Notwithstanding the socioeconomic importance of the mestizo population, however, before the 1952 revolution in Bolivia, the word campesino or peasant was rarely used to designate rural folk living in the countryside. Instead, Rural workers were still called Indians, a term coined by the colonial state to differentiate the native people from European Spaniards. The persistence of the word Indian in the Bolivian lexicon was indicative of how ingrained segregative practices were in social behavior, as rural workers were excluded from fully exercising their rights as citizens due to their alleged position as Indians at the bottom of the social structure. My book explores the genesis and evolution of the peasant movement in the Cochabamba valleys and follows peasants as they struggle to develop their own campesino identity as part of a fight for unionization, access to land ownership, education, and political representation and autonomy during the revolutionary era between 1952 to 1964. Therefore, my research uncovers the campesino voices and restores political agency to the revolutionary peasants in Cochabamba, demonstrating that far from being passive political actors subordinated to the revolutionary state's policies, campesinos were active political actors fighting for the right to shape the terms of their own history.
As you mentioned, your work primarily focuses on Cochabamba, and your book vindicates the importance of regional history. So why do you think regional history matters?
Well, geography and population mobility have always defined regional social structures and cultural differences in the Andes. And any historical account of Andean people must have its foundation in these two factors. Cochabamba is at the center of Bolivia, and from this privileged geographical position, it has access to three ecological niches: the Western Andean Highlands or Altiplano, the Central Inter-Andean Valleys, and the Eastern Subtropical Lowlands or Yungas. Historically, people from the highlands were forced to temporarily colonize territories in the valleys and lowlands in order to cultivate some specific products to complement their diets, for example, maize in the valleys and coca leaves in the Yungas. In the late 15th century, Inca Tupac Yupanqui expanded his Cusco-based empire to encompass the Cochabamba Valley and redistributed plots of land to his allies in the Altiplano. It was Tupac Yupanqui's heir, Inca Huayna Capac, however, who transformed the valley society in the early 16th century, organizing a maize enclave only a few decades before the Spanish conquistador, Francisco Pizarro, arrived in Peru in 1532. As a consequence, since the late pre-colonial period, society in the Cochabamba valleys has always been multi-ethnic and multilingual. Therefore, Cochabamba's long-term outcomes, historical outcomes, are in fact unique and strikingly different when compared to societies in the highlands or the lowlands. In the Altiplano region, for instance, where colonial Indian territories and communities persisted until the 20th century, a comunario political culture based on ancestral bonds, traditional ethnic authorities, and communal links to the Bolivian state was prevalent. Meanwhile, in the Cochabamba valleys, where the colonial haciendas and the Indian communal territories were both fragmented by late 19th century, a freelance rural worker or campesino political culture was dominant. For this mobile peasant population of the valleys, the 1952 revolution opened a window of opportunity to struggle for unionization, education, and political representation. This is the reason why the first chapter of my book is devoted to analyze the regional history of Cochabamba Valleys and the genesis of its campesino population. Now, this analytical endeavor aims to clearly differentiate the valley peasant as the subject of my study, in contrast to the comunario political actor in the Altiplano. I think that this is a key analytical effort in order to clarify the current theoretical tendency to subsume the rural workers' revolutionary struggles in Bolivia under a common identity of the indigenous people.
When you're dealing with Cochabamba, your work discusses a term that has been the subject of a lot of analysis in Latin American literature. I'm talking of the word mestizo and mestizaje, words that you already mentioned in this interview. But you state that we should not understand the word mestizaje as an abstract or a vague idea, but as a term that refers to concrete local histories. Why is it important to understand this term for someone who's not familiar with Bolivian history?
I would argue that the term mestizaje within the historical context of the Cochabamba Valley can be equated to the idea of popular resistance. However, to validate this equation, we must firstly consider ethnicity as a fluid rather than a static process. And secondly, consider ethnicity and class as interwoven factors when analyzing identity formation issues. Beginning in the colonial era, the Cochabamba Valley had the highest concentrations of mestizos in Upper Peru, or the geographical area now composing Bolivia. Seeking to avoid colonial tribute, Indians fled from their reducciones, or colonial Indian territories, and sheltered in the valley haciendas, simultaneously shifting their Indian identity to mestizo. In the late 18th century, mestizos were a third of the total population of Cochabamba, and a century later, they were more than half. In the early 20th century, the crisis in the haciendas worsened because of the loss of their markets for agricultural products in the Altiplano, as railroads were built to export minerals and import agricultural products. But at the same time, the tin mining boom allowed peasant miners to consolidate their economies and purchase plots of land put on the market by bankrupt landlords. By mid-20th century, piqueros, or smallholders, were thriving in the Cochabamba Valley. The 1952 revolution triggered the formation of peasant unions, which were the main sphere of political debate and indoctrination. The unions gathered together the dispersed rural mestizo population. And for the first time in Bolivian history, campesinos built their own political space of public representation and identity vis-a-vis the rest of society. The impact of unionism on the subjectivity of the peasants was extraordinary, because the union allowed a previously atomized, marginalized, and despised mestizo people to feel as acting members of a national project under the common identity of campesino. Neither the political rhetoric nor the everyday discourse of rural peoples in Cochabamba, however, fully employed the term mestizo to identify any of its members. Instead, it was the identity of the campesino that was seen as able to negotiate effectively with the revolutionary state and with the other social groups. This was because, from the perspective of the hacienda colonos, or tenants, who had led the struggles for civil rights and access to land in the Valley States, the context of negotiation for both sets of demands was primarily political and only secondarily ethnic. Therefore, class position was fundamental to the social and political context of the 1952 revolution, and consequently, the peasant used it to formulate their alliances and identify their opponents.
You already mentioned this, but I want to make it explicit. I wonder if you can explain what were the prevailing interpretations of the Bolivian Revolution,
and by contrast, telling us how your interpretation of the revolution is rethinking the field.
The historiography of the Bolivian Revolution during the 1960s and 1970s focused either on state institutions or on political parties and their ideologies, and portrayed the proletarian mine worker as the central revolutionary actor. Historians considered the role of the peasants as marginal because they, allegedly, did not pursue any revolutionary aim. Peasants were also perceived by these authors as a pre-modern group that had to be educated to fully participate in national politics. Now, the 1980s and 1990s were witness to what might be called an ethnic wave in Latin America. Workers' unions globally and in Latin America suffered under prolonged attack and were practically dismantled as a consequence of the broad application of neoliberal policies. Social analysts reacted by abandoning the concept of class struggle and replace it with the conceptual web of ethnic confrontation. As a result, workers and peasants and their political agendas were not interesting anymore. Rather, it was the indigenous people who emerged as the new icon of social conflict and revolution. In Bolivia, some seminal studies regarding the peasantry were published in the 1980s. On the one hand, studies asserting that the agrarian reform was launched by the MNR regime and that peasants were incorporated into the agrarian reform process solely as subordinated actors. To be more specific, these studies claim that, in contrast to the Altiplano Comunarios, the Cochabamba Valley peasants did not have the communal shield to protect themselves from the MNR's hegemonic domination. This position of inherent subjugation, a position that had motivated the peasant leaders to sign the Peasant Military Pact in 1964, allowed the peasants to actively participate in the conspiracy against the eventual ouster of the revolutionary MNR by military coup. Consequently, these studies assert, as peasants had proved to be manipulable, only ethnic or indigenous movements could succeed in the future. But on the other hand, regional history studies were also published in the 1980s that changed the scholarly perception of the Cochabamba peasantry, asserting that since the early colonial period, Indians in the Altiplano fled the reducciones and sheltered in the valley haciendas while simultaneously shifting their Indian identity to mestizo. Consequently, previously canonical essentialist conceptualizations of closed ethnic groups with immutable cultures living separately in the Altiplano and the valleys were called into question. Ethnic identities were indeed fluid, for people were able to trespass ethnic boundaries if it was in their social or political interest to do so. My study was inspired by this new perception of ethnicity as a fluid process, and it aims to restore political agency to the peasants as the dynamic actors of the revolution. And as you certainly know, I am not alone in this endeavor. For recent revisionist studies regarding revolutionary comunarios agrarian reform projects in the Altiplano, or popular sectors' participation in the water war of Cochabamba, or middle-class perceptions on the process of revolutionary nationalization of foreign oil companies in Bolivia, among others, also focus on restoring political agency to previously ignored actors of the 1952 revolution.
Jose, 2022 marks the year in which we are commemorating the 70th anniversary of the Bolivian Revolution. And I want you to talk about now about the legacies of the revolution, of the Bolivian Revolution, since you give us this overview of the centrality and the agency of peasants and the peasant movement in Cochabamba in the 1950s.
I strongly believe that the 1952 revolution still has a profound influence on current Bolivian politics. In spite of efforts to undermine its significance as a major nationalist revolution, both the academic and political ethnic turn of the 1980s, as well as the election of Evo Morales as the first indigenous president in 2006, gave rise to revisionist interpretations of the 1952 Bolivian Revolution. Scholars in the 200s and 210s focused their attention on the indigenous peoples of the highlands, adopting a de facto altiplano-centric perspective. This ethnic approach to the 1952 revolution allowed some scholars to proclaim that previous revolutions occurred before 1952. For instance, the Tupac Katari bloody rebellion in the colonial era, or the 1954 movement of indigenous peoples in the Altiplano that utilized the legal tools created by liberal governments in efforts to preserve their communal lands. I would argue, however, that whatever the level of violence reached, or no matter the outcomes of various legal wranglings and maneuverings, the social conflict that occurred before and after the 1952 to 1964 revolutionary period did not transform Bolivian society in any fundamental or irreversible mode. Therefore, if we do not wish to relativize the concept of revolution in such a way that any major insurrection should be seen as a revolutionary event, there must be some common parameters employed to qualify social conflict at the level of a revolution. In my opinion, recent political events culminating in the demise of Evo Morales' regime in 2019 and the resulting call for new elections indicate that the ethnic cycle is declining in Bolivia. From 2006 to 2019, Morales ruled three consecutive presidential terms. Although his political party, MAS, was supported by the politically and economically powerful coca leaf growers, cocaleros unions in the subtropical Chapare region, ethnic discourse portraying him as the first original indigenous president of Bolivia provided his regime with crucial symbolic representation. However, political discourse during the presidential electoral campaign in 2020 did not prioritize ethnicity anymore. Mm. Instead, class-based issues received all attention. Moreover, Evo Morales was not the mass candidate in the 2020 election, and it's foreseeable that, despite the mass re-election, class will overcome ethnicity as the main referent in future political discourse. As my book deals with the genesis of the campesino identity and the consolidation of the peasant movement that fought for unionization and political autonomy during the revolutionary period in Cochabamba, it will not only contribute to the specific understanding of current Cocalero Union's political behavior, but also to the general discussion of the peasants' revolutionary role in Latin America.
Jose, thank you so much for coming to the program, for taking the time to do this. We learned a lot with this interview. Thank you again.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
I'm sure you're wondering about the song that we used to start and to close the program today. It is a huayno, which is a musical genre typical of the Central Andean region. The music is especially common in Peru, Bolivia, and northern Argentina, and it's practiced by a variety of ethnic groups, especially the Quechua people. This is all for today. I hope you enjoy the program. Until the next time.